morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the City of Sioux Falls Appellant versus Daniel Daly Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Michael Henderson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Mr. Daly, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, Jr., an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Henderson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Henderson. I'm an attorney from Sioux Falls. I'm here today on behalf of the City of Sioux Falls, the appellant in this matter. This case stems from an action brought for a declaratory judgment commenced in May of 2008. The case was finally concluded in by findings of fact and conclusions of law entered in November of 2009, and after that a judgment entered in June of 2010 by Judge Caldwell. The basic facts underlying this matter stem back to the summer of 2004. The appellee in this matter, Daniel Daly, during that summer had a driveway extension put on, I think about 7 feet, extending his driveway on one side. Notable in this particular situation is that Mr. Daly has a fire hydrant that is near the curb of his property there, and the driveway extension essentially extended out so that the fire hydrant was beyond the fire hydrant, essentially. After he put this driveway extension in 2004, nothing happened until the spring of 2006. At this point in time, Mr. Daly was approached by a code enforcement officer with the city who indicated to Mr. Daly that the driveway extension was a violation of city ordinance, and that if he wanted to maintain the driveway extension, that it would be advisable that he seek a variance from the Zoning Board of Adjustment with the city. Based upon that, Mr. Daly did just that. He applied for a variance with the Zoning Board of Adjustment. And a hearing took place in June of 2006 before the Zoning Board of Adjustment. At the conclusion of the hearing, the board denied his request for a variance. One of the Exhibit E from the trial court is kind of a typewritten summary of the testimony in the before the Zoning Board of Adjustment. One of their major concerns was the existence of this fire hydrant that was near the curb, and the possibility that having the driveway extension in the place that it was would create a danger that someone could back into that fire hydrant. Mr. Daly appealed the decision by the Zoning Board of Adjustment through the city's administrative procedures. On July 17th of 2006, this came before a hearing examiner, Sarah Burnett.
Is the city's position that this was a civil citation or a criminal citation?
A civil citation, Your Honor.
And what was the penalty?
The penalty, I believe, was a $100 fine. And I don't, based upon the record, it's my understanding that I don't believe that I believe the extension still exists at this time, and I don't know that any fine has been paid at this time, but that was the citation that was given was a $100 fine.
But this appeal doesn't concern the request for a variance and the denial, is it? This appeal is concerning only the issue of the citation.
Correct. What happened is after the appeal from the variance denial, Mr. Daly was cited, and eventually it's a little bit unclear exactly how this took place, and the record is a little bit muddled. There were several citations issued. Eventually, the matter did come before a hearing examiner for a hearing. That happened in April of 2007. At that time...
So just to back up, who actually issues the citation? How is that issued?
The citation is issued by a code enforcement officer from the city.
All right. Is there any appeal or is there any hearing on the citation itself? I think the position I saw was, well, when you have a hearing, it's actually an appeal. But is there a hearing on the actual factual basis for the citation?
The the appeal process from the citation, the appellant in that case is permitted to challenge the citation in whatever way they deem appropriate, the factual basis included. But the initial step is that there is this first this citation, then there is the commencement of the appeal process in which the appellant...
Appeal from what?
The appeal is from the citation itself.
The city, he's appealing from a city employee standing on his front door handing him a ticket.
That's essentially the case.
So he's, what, guilty until proven innocent?
Your Honor, I would... a couple of things about that point. That's one of the undercurrents of the appellee's argument here is that what the process does is reverse the traditional burden of proof. I would cite point the court to a few things. One, this is... It's not entirely unheard of or unusual that in this type of administrative procedure that the appellant challenging a citation has the burden of proof. I gave the example
of... Normally, though, in the cases that you've cited as well, usually there's an agency or there's some kind of a fact-finding group somewhere that you appeal from. How does that fit with this?
That's true. I think, and the examples I've given are of an appeal from a special assessment issued by a city for a sidewalk or something like that. Also, a property tax assessment made by a county. In this case, essentially, the finder here is the code enforcement officer who issues the citation. There's the initial citation, and then the appeal comes from that. But my point is that it's not unusual or unheard of that there be a negative action against a person and that they have the burden of proving that the city's action in that case was incorrect.
Okay, but general tenets of due process require a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time, and if you reverse the burden of proof and also there's no subpoena power and the hearing is before either administrative judge hired by the city or city panel, at what point, if they issue a citation, there's no subpoena power, how would he get even a city official to appear to question him on the basis of the citation?
There is, you're correct in that the ordinance don't provide for subpoena power. there is, in this particular instance, there's no assertion that a city, there were no city employees or city officers were not present at the hearing or were unable to, he was unable to call them at the hearing. In practice, how this works with the city basically is they, and I think the record will show that in the past, city officers are available, and if a person wants to call them, they can call them during the administrative appeal process. But it's not entirely different from a assessment for property taxes. In that case, the assessment is made. There's no hearing before the assessment is made. The determination is made as to the assessment, and from that point, the appellant has the right to appeal that, challenge the assessment, but has the burden of proving that the assessment was wrong.
Well, that's not really accurate. The city council has to determine that there's going to be a special assessment, and all citizens are given notice and can go down and complain that the assessment's not necessary.
That's true in the case of a special assessment, but I was referring to the case of a property tax assessment. But the point being is that there, once the assessment is made, it's similar to the citation in this case. The appellant is the party that has the burden of proving that the assessment was incorrect. And he's not limited in doing so, it goes to the heart of the citation itself, essentially. Basically, our concerns about the findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by the trial court ultimately here is what happened at the conclusion. It was a four-day trial. For reasons that aren't entirely clear, the four-day trial occurred over a period of about 9 months. And the final day of trial, the trial court did not ask for briefs or anything of that nature, but instead asked the parties to submit proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. The parties did that. Ultimately, the trial court in, I think, November of 2009 signed findings of fact and conclusions of law, essentially signed the findings of fact, I think every finding of fact proposed by counsel for Mr. Daly.
But you aren't really, as I look through, you aren't really contesting the facts.
We're not contesting the facts, Your Honor. What we are contesting is that the findings of fact that were signed and the conclusions of the law, which were also prepared by counsel for Mr. Daly, which we do challenge, that those findings do not support the conclusions, and that there is no analytical connection between the findings and the conclusions.
What kind of relief are you seeking then from this court?
I think that we're looking for the relief that we would seek, Your Honor, would be a remand of this matter for further proceedings, and whether that is asking the trial court to go back and reissue the findings of fact and conclusions of law based upon the trial that's already occurred, or you know, potentially a retrial of the matter. I think that this case got bogged down in a four-day trial.
Let's get back to retrial. You have city employees stating that their procedure, stated policy of the city or their practice was that if a hearing was requested, that they would just issue more citations. How does that comply with due process?
Well, Your Honor, I think that as the trial court's findings of fact themselves indicate, there was a lot of confusion about exactly when a hearing was requested and whether a hearing took place initially.
All right, but she stated that that was the policy of the city, that if someone asked for a hearing, they just got cited again, and that's what happened here.
Well, ultimately, as you said, the due process requires that a party have a meaningful hearing at a meaningful time. Here, he ultimately did have a hearing. In fact, he had a hearing from the various decision. He had another hearing on the citation. There was confusion. I acknowledge that it was perhaps clumsily handled at times, and that there was confusion about the initial citation and the initial attempt to appeal from that citation, and then another citation was issued. But essentially, eventually the matter did come before the hearing examiner for a hearing, and we believe that hearing itself is what's being challenged, and that hearing was appropriate. A couple of things I'd like to get into regarding the trial court's decision here, and this is why we believe that the trial court's conclusions merit reversal and remand. The first conclusion reached by the trial court was essentially that the rules of evidence, because the rules of evidence did not apply during the administrative proceeding, that the administrative procedures ordinances violate due process. And I think we've pointed to a number of instances. It's not out of the ordinary, and in fact, it's pretty standard in administrative procedures that the technical rules of evidence do not apply. That's in almost every level of administrative procedures, including procedures under the State Administrative Procedures Act. That's the case. I'd like to point out one thing, that counsel for Mr. Daly has indicated that the city has challenged the finding that the administrative procedures ordinances were unconstitutional as written, but has not challenged the finding that they were unconstitutional based upon the manner in which they were applied in this case. I disagree with that contention. What if you look at the conclusions of law, the trial court first found that the manner in which they were applied was unconstitutional, then found that as written they were unconstitutional, and then said specifically in the following ways this was unconstitutional, and then listed, I believe, eight things. And we've challenged each and every one of those eight things. Some of those deal with the manner in which the ordinances were applied. Some of those deal with the ordinances on their face, such as the instance of the rules of evidence.
Just to clear up one thing before
yes.
we get too far into it, and that's on the issue of Article 9, Section 2 of the South Dakota Constitution on Home Rule.
Yes.
Provides certain requirements for home rule. Specifically, the clause that's concerning is, and the administrative proceedings be subject to judicial review
And there's been some other cases that have dealt with whether or not the city of Sioux Falls' administrative procedures apply or have appropriate judicial review. As I read this case, that's not an issue in this case as such, is it?
I think that's correct. It's not an issue in this particular case. That's kind of an argument for another case, essentially. But you're correct in that there has been some ongoing cases dealing with that particular issue. There's mention of that in the trial court's findings, but it's not addressed in the trial court's conclusions.
But you're not appealing any, and no part of your appeal addresses that issue, is that correct?
No part of our appeal addresses that issue, and I don't think any part of the trial court's ultimate conclusions and judgment entered in this case really addresses that issue either. So I don't think there was any conclusion reached by the trial court that we would be appealing as it pertains to that particular issue. As I said, it's an argument, I think, for another case, which will ultimately, I'm sure, be here. But the counsel for Mr. Daly has focused on, submission, has focused on three things, essentially. As I mentioned, I think there were eight conclusions as to specifically how Mr. Daly's due process rights were violated. They focused on three things. One is the burden of proof. We've already addressed that. And another was the issue of repeated citations, which we've addressed. And the other dealt with the question of the city attorney that handled this matter at the time during the administrative process objecting a number of times at the administrative hearing. And the argument is essentially that Mr. Daly is told that the technical rules of evidence don't apply, but then there's objections made by the city attorney. Some of those objections were sustained by the hearing examiner. Just to address that point, I think it's important to understand a couple of things. First of all, the city ordinance says that the technical rules of evidence don't apply. Pretty standard in administrative appeals processes. But goes on to also say that the hearing examiner has discretion to exclude evidence that is irrelevant, evidence that is overly cumulative, things of that nature. So there is discretion on the part of the hearing examiner to exclude evidence. So there's certainly, which leads us to believe that certainly there's nothing wrong with objecting. Whether or not the objections were excessive is another question. But another point I think is important to make is
you concede that these were a bit excessive in your brief.
Oh, I don't disagree that I can't remember the number exactly.
68
was excessive. I think an important thing to remember.
Well, but is it? The due process is looking at fairness. Is it fair if the city's attorney's objections are looked at 68 times and the citizen is not entitled to that?
I don't know that there's anything in the record that states that the citizen in this case was precluded from objecting, Your Honor. And in fact, in this hearing, in which the city attorney objected a number of times, Mr. Daly was represented by counsel during that hearing. And as these things tend to happen, when there's lawyers on both sides, I mean, the reason for not applying the technical rules of evidence, as the court is aware, is that it's for the benefit of a person acting pro se. They don't have to worry about knowing the rules of evidence and things of that nature. Here there were attorneys on both sides. Both Mr. Daly was represented by counsel. The city was represented by counsel on the part of the city attorney's office. There's no indication, I believe, in the record that Mr. Dorothy, who was representing Mr. Daly at the time, was ever precluded or told he could not object during that process. And conceitedly, the process, I think, if you look at it, became somewhat more adversarial than it needed to be based upon various factors and the fact, in large part due to the fact that we had attorneys representing both sides, and certainly it became adversarial, and that's what happened. But the fact that there's no indication on the record that Mr. Dorothy was precluded from objecting And while 68 objections may have been excessive, it's also clear under the ordinances that the city attorney is permitted to object, and that the hearing examiner can exclude evidence that he deems irrelevant. I see just a few seconds left, so if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Okay, if not, thank you, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Parsons, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, and Mr. Henderson. As the city's acknowledged, you know, this appeal has its genesis in a 7-foot strip of concrete that Mr. Daly had installed to widen his driveway almost 7 years ago in the summer of 2004.
Do you concede that that was in violation of the ordinance?
We do not. I think the ordinances are extremely vague and ambiguous. And that was part of the case that Mr. Daly was attempting to make at these hearings and was prevented from making. And in addition, this case, particular branch of this case, started with a declaratory judgment action brought by Mr. Daly because under the interpretation of the appellate procedures or review procedures for these types of proceedings, that was the only way he could get the evidence he wanted to into court and have these issues heard. And from the beginning, his declaratory judgment action had two claims, very separate. The first was reflected in, if you look at the judgment that Judge Caldwell made, which is Exhibit 2 to the city's brief, paragraph 2 of the judgment is a finding, a conclusion of law, that the zoning ordinances as applied to Mr. Daly, the zoning ordinances, not the Administrative Procedures Act, that those zoning ordinances violated due process and equal protection as applied to him. And that was based upon the evidence that Judge Caldwell heard at this trial regarding the selective enforcement of this ordinance, the ambiguities in this ordinance that the city couldn't even agree all the time what he was violating, what ordinances applied, also, as Justice Severson mentioned, this policy in enforcing this particular ordinance where if he challenged it and he shows up, files an appeal, which they call it an appeal, but it's really an initial challenge, he shows up and they say, well, we're not going to have the hearing today, go home. And he gets recited and he appeals from those hearings and he shows up for those and tries to appeal those. And they claim he never showed up. And he's recited again, and we have all these separate ordinances. It's really kind of a shell game. But the zoning ordinances, that part of the judge's holding is separate for them, her judgment in paragraph 3 of her judgment, which finds that the administrative procedures apply to Mr. Daly as he attempted to challenge the application of the zoning ordinances, that those also violated his procedural due process rights. So we have kind of a substantive conclusion by the trial court and a procedural conclusion by the trial court. And in the city's notice of appeal and docketing statement, it appealed from both separate parts of that judgment. But when we received the city's brief, its statement of issues dropped any appeal from the substantive element regarding the application of the zoning ordinances. It's nowhere in the brief. It's nowhere in the statement of issues. And so that's the law of the case. And that part is no longer at issue.
This is the judgment that I'm looking at. Is this where she said that the zoning ordinances violated the plaintiff's constitutional right?
That's right.
What you're talking about. And that's not appealed.
It hasn't been appealed from, although they gave notice they were going to appeal from.
So the administrative appeals ordinance is the one that we're really dealing with?
That's
today?
All we're talking about here today.
And when I read those, my question is whether this is even applicable. These administrative appeals ordinances even apply to this kind of a proceeding. When I read them, they say they're appeal from an agency or major organizational unit of the city concerning an administrative decision of a city official or officials.
I think that's exactly right. These things are a mess, and the city has no idea how they apply, how they're to apply them. And what we've seen, you know, the Second Circuit judges here, they're not strangers to these types of controversies. They've been having to deal with the city in its inconsistent and, frankly, deceptive application of these procedures for years and years and years. We've had decisions, and these are in the record, part of Judge Caldwell, the basis for Judge Caldwell's decision was Judge Nealis's decision in the Hong King case and Judge Daniels or Judge Sirska's decision in the Daniels case. And there what we have is the city never appeals from those decisions. So those are really binding in the law of the case too, but because they're never allowed to make their way up to this court, they're simply free to ignore them. And actually in the Daniels case, Judge Sirska has already instructed the city, held in a binding judgment that they never appealed from, that the city, its reversal of the burden of proof here is unconstitutional. They never appealed from that decision, and they never followed it. They just ignored it. And so that's part of the problem is we have a city government that is ignoring the judgments made by the circuit court and not appealing from it. So, in effect, they've created this system where they're immune from scrutiny.
Is that really before us, though?
It's part of the situation that's before us, but it's not the precise issue. The precise issue in this case is the constitutionality of the procedural due process rights of the ordinance as they were written and as they were applied to Mr. Daly in this case. You're right, Justice Enter. And that part that has been appealed should also be affirmed. And here's why I think it should. This is not, as we said, a challenge to the correctness of the finding. What this is about regarding the zoning ordinances, that's settled. What this is about is whether the relationship between government and its citizens, and the relationship in particular between the government and Mr. Daly in this case. Procedural due process is a kind of an amorphous, vaguely defined concept because it needs to be adaptable, because it is situational. But it is concrete in what it requires, in that procedures must be fundamentally fair. And not only do they have to be fundamentally fair, they have to give our citizens confidence that they are fair. So it's not just actual fairness, but it's apparent fairness, because that is required so that citizens have confidence in the decisions that their government's making and the power that it wields. And so here, what we have is a challenge to how Mr. Daly's challenge to these ordinances was dealt with by the city. Again, as you said, Justice Meyer, it's not clear that these procedures it applied are even applicable to this type of situation.
But they did apply.
But they did apply them. And if they do apply them, they have to apply them in a fair manner that gives him a meaningful and timely opportunity to be heard and that gives him essential fairness. And so when the U.S. Supreme Court and this court examines that type of situation, it looks to the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test. And that has three factors. It's you consider the nature of the private interest at stake.
But let me stop you right
yeah.
there. There's a sentence in the appellant's brief that it most certainly would have. It said it saying the trial court did not make any effort to analyze the issue based on the nature of the right involved. If it had, it would most certainly have recognized that this case involves an ordinary property right and does not implicate any personal or liberty interest that would give rise to heightened constitutional protection. Would you address the ordinary property right?
Yeah, I don't understand what that's meant to imply, because we're talking about a person's home, and there's few things that are more protected under the law than someone's home or place of residence.
So is that the right we're talking about here?
Yes.
A property right as far as the land?
The land, his home, his driveway.
Is that the issue, or is it the fact that they're citing him and asking for his money?
Well, and that's part of it, too. I mean, the only way for him to avoid, and as you said, their policy is they'll just keep citing you and citing you and citing you until you give up. And so eventually what you have to do is get a jackhammer and dig up your driveway if you want to avoid these repeated citations. And so it's a property interest, it's a monetary interest, but I think it's all entangled, you know, together. It's not a liberty interest as we've argued it. So we're not talking about, you know, depriving someone of their liberty. It's not heightened scrutiny, but it's certainly ordinary due process scrutiny, and that's something that requires all these elements of due process. I mean, and the important thing too is these administrative appeals ordinances don't just apply to zoning violations. They use this in a large majority of contexts. breaches of contract between city contractors and the city, as the Daniels case was. And they apply this across the board. And so these procedures, as written, deal with varying scopes of property rights. Some could be, you know, tens of thousands and maybe millions of dollars.
What happens under this procedure if your client simply ignores the ticket?
He gets another one, probably. I mean, the policy is that they keep citing you and citing you. But here, of course, he didn't ignore the ticket. He tried to appeal it. And when he showed up for the hearing that he'd received, they said, go home. And then he gets more tickets. And he shows up for another hearing, and he's told, you know, go home again, according to the Judge Caldwell's factual findings. Now, they say he never showed up for that hearing. But he introduced evidence, say, it's on my calendar. I talked with my attorney about it. And Judge Caldwell found that occurred. So, but getting back to the balancing test, what we have is a private interest, but it's a property interest, and it's a very important one. It's a significant interest. And the kind of the heart of the test in Matthews is you have to weigh the risk of erroneous deprivation of the interest through the procedures that have been utilized, and then the probable value that additional procedures would add in preventing erroneous deprivations. And here, that really weighs so strongly in favor of Judge Caldwell's ruling, because what the evidence showed is we have an adversarial process where the goal seemed to be to win at all costs, even if we have to keep dismissing tickets and refiling them, rescheduling hearings, and the system itself, as written, as set up, does not allow the citizen who's being charged with an adequate attempt to make his case. And what we had here was the city attorney, anytime Mr. Daley attempted to present all of his evidence of selective enforcement, how he criticized the government and then these tickets get issued, how virtually a third of his neighbors, he lives in a sea of these extensions, and basically a third of his neighbors have the exact same extensions, and yet none of them are ever cited. And he tried to present that evidence, and anytime he tried to present evidence, the city attorney would say, evidentiary rules don't apply. You know, that evidence isn't coming in. And the hearing examiner would sustain them. And then the city attorney, however, was applying the rules of evidence. And so we have a imbalanced application of the rules. I agree that you don't have to have formal rules of evidence, don't have to apply as if it were in a courtroom. I agree we don't need that level of due process.
Can we talk about the burden of proof for a minute before your time runs out?
Yes.
Counsel's argued a couple of times this morning and in his brief that this isn't much different from the general property tax assessment process, where you each year you get assessed, and if you want to challenge it, the burden is on you, the property owner, to show that the assessment is wrong. And in fact, we've said in several cases that the Board of Equalization is presumed correct. So how is that different? Why is that a wrong process in this case when it's not wrong in assessing property taxes?
I think it's wrong in this case because here there is no initial adjudication. I mean, the what they call the appeal is an initial adjudication and an initial determination. It's the only place where evidence is brought in, where assessments of evidence are made, is the first time that occurs. And this court has held in the City of Pier versus Blackwell case that where there is a deprivation of property, the city is required to prove that by a preponderance of the evidence.
Where is the initial adjudication in a property tax assessment? It's automatic. You get assessed, you get an assessment in the mail, and you get to appeal it, and then there's the hearing.
Well, I'm assuming that there's there's some sort of assessment and valuation that's made by a board. As I understand the process, I guess I'm not familiar enough with those procedures, but as I understood it, there is an initial application of factors to the aspects of the home and calculations made that give at least something for the court to review. And here,
but there's no hearing in the sense that you're given notice that the Director of Equalization is going to look at your house today. There's no hearing in that nature. There's just you just get a piece of paper saying, here's your assessment. If you wish to challenge it, you have so many days, and that's. Seems to be somewhat similar to what the city's saying here. If you have a code violation on your property, here's what we're saying you violated. And if you don't challenge it within so many days, it's going to be an irrebuttable presumption that you did violate.
And, of course, he did challenge it. I'd say, you know, what it may be a difference.
I guess what you're saying is you don't see a difference.
I do see a difference because what you do is you go back to the balancing test. And it's always situational. And maybe in when you're talking about whether this is the appropriate tax to assess, that's not something that depends on concrete factual findings necessarily. It may not be. Here in this situation, when you apply the balancing test, the risk of erroneous deprivation by switching the burden of proof is immense. The city officials here could not even at times agree as to what the ordinances required. I mean, these are ambiguous ordinances, and many ordinances are poorly written, as I'm sure this court is very familiar with. And so when you have poorly written, ambiguous ordinances, and then someone has to come in and is not even told what they have to prove. I mean, what are you accusing me of violating? They have to come in and try to make their case that they didn't violate something that they may not even understand. And so the risk of an erroneous deprivation in that case is so great, and the probable benefit of just saying, well, wait a minute, let's at least make the city come in and say, this is what you were accusing you of. This is exactly how we feel that you violated this ordinance, and here's why. So you have an opportunity to respond. What is the cost of that? What is the burden imposed on the government of that? I mean, it's nothing. I mean, that's why there's zero evidence in the record, and that's the third factor, is how the government is burdened by these suggested procedures. There's no evidence that the city would be burdened at all. I mean, these things should be happening right now. They should have fair procedures that should be applied equally. They should be able to tell the person up front, this is what we think you did and here's why, so the person has a meaningful opportunity to respond. I mean, there's no cost at all to having the city follow these same basic structures. We don't need the formal rules of evidence, but we need fairness.
It just to make sure everyone, we're all talking about the same thing. I asked the same thing of Mr. Henderson. Article 9, Section 2, you agree also that that's not ripe in this case?
It's not ripe in this case, although it's part of the record. And it shows how the city, I mean, basically what they do is they would say, now you can go appeal this. Go appeal, they'd instruct them. You can go appeal this issue to the circuit court. And they'd go do that, and then the city would file a motion to dismiss saying, you don't have no right to appeal this. And, you know, they're speaking out of both sides of their mouth, and it so frustrated the judges in the Second Circuit that we had this series of decisions criticizing that. And so it's part of the context of this process, and it shows how disorganized and, frankly, abusive these processes have been utilized. So it's part of the record, but it's not an issue that was noticed.
When were these ordinances drafted, do you know?
Boy, the administrative procedure ordinances? I think it's on the exhibit. I don't have it. I have the exhibit in front of me. I don't know. But they preexisted Mr. Daley's involvement. The only change that's been made is they used to instruct that you had the right to appeal, and now as a result of the Daniels decision, they did change the wording and say you have the right to judicial review of these ordinances, which tracks Article 9.
The one says 2007 S11. I wonder if that's the year. Or...
It predates the ordinance. The administrative procedures predate that. That was a revision, I'm sure. They do predate Mr. Daley's charge because he invoked these ordinances when he was ticketed.
Back to the findings of the trial court. You know, these are a little bit unusual findings in terms of their breadth and detail. And I understand the criticism, and maybe they're not in total wrong, but there's certain aspects of it. For instance, the rules of evidence findings. You know, I don't know how they can stand. How that can stand by itself. Because I don't think the rules of evidence have to apply to afford due process.
Well, and I think we've modified our understanding of the order. And, you know, I would concede, and we've conceded in our brief, I said the formal rules of evidence as they exist in courtrooms don't need to be applied in their entirety in an administrative proceeding. I concede that. On the other hand, I think the really part of what it was saying was that the rules of evidence have to be applied fairly. To the extent the rules are applied, they must be applied fairly. And I think that's the gist of I think what Judge Caldwell was getting at. But I agree. We don't need the entire code in South Dakota codified laws regarding rules of evidence. That does not need to be applied at every administrative proceeding. I agree. But here we had. Well, my time is about up. I just would like to say, governments are vested with truly impressive power, and it can be terrifying power. And citizens need to have a measure of confidence that when the government exercises that power, when city officials who are charged with exercising that power do so, they need confidence that it will be exercised in a fundamentally fair manner. And this decision is just a very small step in restoring that confidence, and I ask that it be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Anderson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
There's one finding that let me ask you about.
Yes.
That it's 22, where there was some testimony that all zoning citations are entirely citizen complaint driven, and that the city does not issue a zoning citation unless a citizen has formally complained about the zoning ordinance violation. Does this citation only come because some citizen had complained?
I think that I don't think that. And one of the things I wish about this case is that we had a little better record. But I don't think there's anything in the record that shows a specific citizen complaining in this instance. There was testimony at the court trial that's generally how citations occur. Is
so there's
somebody
no
complains.
Body or even an employee. There's no board or employee like tax assessments, for instance, that actually looks at this. According to the city's own testimony, it's complaint driven.
Well, it is complaint driven according to the city's testimony. There is a code enforcement officer who is charged with the responsibility of enforcement.
But there's nothing in the record that would indicate that it goes before any kind of review before it's issued.
No. A determination, I believe, Justice Meyer Henry, is made by the code enforcement officer. Most commonly that's in response to a citizen complaint. But the citizen complaint doesn't generate the citation. The complaint occurs. The code enforcement officer reviews the situation, determines whether or not, in his judgment, a violation is there, and then, if so, issues a citation.
One thing, when I was looking at this case, I was trying to figure out, and it kind of goes to where we're at, there's in the procedure, the citation is issued, there's an irrebuttable presumption, unless it's appealed, and then if it's appealed, I guess wait for a decision. In this case, there's at least four citations. There's a number of appeals. What's the city? I couldn't even figure out what the city thinks that Mr. Daley owes. What do they think he owes in this case?
I'm not sure if I have a very good answer to that.
Is there a problem with the procedure?
I don't dispute that the process of how that was handled was perhaps clumsy. There's really... The ultimate point here, though, is ultimately this did get to a hearing. It's unclear, and even I think the trial court acknowledges, I don't know if a hearing occurred on this date or if it was supposed to or what. It was obviously a very cluttered process. From my standpoint, the city's viewpoint is that there was a citation, and really, the appropriate thing is that the citation came before hearing examiner for a hearing. And, really, if it had been less clumsily handled, there should be one citation, one hearing. But I think that where we got to eventually with the hearing satisfied due process, and that while it was a bit messy getting there, there was a hearing from the citation eventually, and Mr. Daley was afforded due process.
But how does that hearing comply with City of Pierre versus Blackwell?
I'm sorry?
How did that hearing comply City of Pierre versus Blackwell?
In what way, Your Honor?
Well, the burden of proof.
And the issue of burden of proof.
Yeah.
Well, I believe certainly the. I would liken it to a property tax assessment. I mean, the citation is made. There is
this isn't property tax. In Blackwell, the city alleged that a citizen, you know, violated city ordinances. And we said due process requires more than what was afforded here.
Well, I think that here, and I'm not completely familiar with the facts here, but here there was the issue is burden of proof, but there was a hearing afforded. Yeah, he had the opportunity to appear. He had the opportunity to present evidence. He had the opportunity to call witnesses. There's a question certainly as to that burden of proof, but it's not our point is that generally in an appeals process, the appellant has the burden of proof, and this is different than that. There was a full and complete hearing held.
But again, you know, going back to Justice Meyer's question, I don't see how this is an appeal. I mean, appealing from what? There was never a hearing or an adjudication that he could have appealed from. It was just a city enforcement officer's judgment that he had violated a code provision. There was no hearing to appeal from.
That's correct. There was no underlying hearing. There was the citation issued by the court enforcement officer. How these have been challenged in the past is through this process, through this appeals process. That's what Mr. Daly did, and that's the process that was applied. I certainly understand your point that it is different than a situation where there is an underlying adjudication.
So when this happens and the government alleges that a citizen has violated a provision of the of law, isn't it the government's obligation in the first instance to carry the burden of proving what they allege the citizen did?
Well, I guess I understand the point. What I would just simply say is as we set forth in our brief, there are a number of situations in which the burden of proof can be reversed. We cited in our initial brief, I don't remember the case, but we quoted extensively in our initial brief, and it indicates in that case it's that state's administrative procedure process. The burden of proof is initially on the appellant, and that's what we have here. And it's a balancing act. As to what due process requires based upon the right involved and various other factors. We believe here that one of the problems we have here is that there's no way to understand what the trial court's analysis was here in getting from its findings to its conclusions. You know, Mr. Parsons has acknowledged that there's certain aspects of the conclusions that are essentially wrong. The conclusion it was, and I understand his argument that's the gist of what the trial court was getting at was different than that, but the conclusion by the trial court was that specifically the following violated plaintiff's constitutional right to due process of law. Number 1A, section 2-62(1), which states that administrative hearings do not have to be conducted according to the rules of evidence. I read that as saying, by providing that the administrative hearing does not have to be conducted according to the rules of evidence, the city has violated Mr. Daly's constitutional rights. And there's a number of others. There's things such as the subpoena power. Essentially, they indicate you have to have subpoena power. There's things such as the finding that by having messy files, essentially, and not having well-organized files, they violated his due process rights. There's the finding that there was not an adequate record. The tape recording was bad of the hearing, and that violated his due process rights. Well, my concern here, and the city's concern, is that the overreaching nature of these conclusions really, part of the problem here is, you know, Mr. Daly has, one of his themes here is that, you know, I'm not looking for a money judgment or anything like that. I just want a fair process, and I want to fix the process. One of the concerns here is, if there's something wrong with the process, and if there's something wrong with these administrative appeals ordinances, these conclusions provide very little guidance to the city as to what exactly is wrong and what needs to be fixed. I mean, if you apply them literally, the city would need to adopt the rules of evidence and require that the rules of evidence apply. And I don't think that's to the benefit of anyone, really. And counsel for Mr. Daly has indicated that he agrees that they don't need to apply.
But there has to be some process where everybody knows what the rules are and they abide by it. And wasn't that the problem that the court recognizes, that maybe they're all one-sided in this case? It's the catch-22. They don't apply, but we'll object to everything.
I understand that. I think that a couple of things. There is a right to object, certainly, as the ordinances indicate. Both parties were represented by counsel. But I think the larger picture is that the real problem here is that we have these conclusions, which are attorney-drafted conclusions, which were signed by the trial court. The effect of them, it goes beyond, for one, it provides a little guidance to the city as to how to fix anything that's wrong here. But the other effect of them is it establishes and sets a precedent that, okay, apparently now the rules of evidence need to apply to administrative proceedings. That's literally what the trial court held. And I think for those reasons, I would suggest and request that this matter be remanded to the trial court for further proceedings.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.